Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Case is on Hold, number 60. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Andrew Schoenfeld. You are?
The Deputy Editor for Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Perfect. And I'm Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor of Adult Reconstruction. Of note, these opinions are solely our own and no one else at JBJS. They don't represent anyone on the board. This is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. If you want to get some extra learning, always have the Miller Review Course. Step two, board review is right around the corner. Just happened. And so if you have any questions or concerns, sign up for the next time. When you're ready for board, it's a good thing to have. I'm going to start us off at the top of the pile of what's new in spine surgery by Helgeson. It's permanently free. Evaluating diagnostic performance of MRI for identification of meniscal ramp lesions in ACL deficient knees, a systematic review and meta-analysis by Mota Shirakek. What's important from the patient perspective, cultivating agency for patients and parents by Day. This is permanently free. There's a nice recap of the 2023 Austrian-Swiss-German Fellowship by Mullis et al. Assessing the accuracy and reliability of AI-generated responses to patient questions regarding spine surgery by Kashthuri et al. There's an obituary on Robert or Bob Voltz, 1932 to 2023, which is permanently free. Now we're going to go on to the headlines. Dr. Schoenfeld, tell us about fixation or revision for periprosthetic fractures. Epidemiology, New Trends, and Projections, United States, by Minutilo et al., and there's an infographic on this.
All right, so this study is looking at periprosthetic fractures in the setting of total hips and total knees, and they basically took the Pearl Diver database. Between 2016 and 2021, they examined the number of patients who had periprosthetic fractures, and then they looked to develop projection estimates in terms of the number of individuals who would be developing periprosthetic fractures in the future. We've covered these types of national projection studies in the past. Their stated goal was to examine and project trends in the operative treatment of periprosthetic fractures in the U.S. This is always a challenge. All projections are incorrect. They're models. They're always wrong, but some are useful. That's the standard. These are just models. And the further out you go in a model, the less precise you're going to be. I also feel like these studies tend to be the no-lose situation for people who want to use like big data type data sets, because it's kind of like you say what you say. Almost always, these studies project astronomical increase in whatever. There's studies out there on the need for spine surgery, for lumbar fusion, for revision, total joint surgery of hips, knees, ankles, shoulders, right? These studies are relatively easy to do. They always make a case that we don't have enough orthopedic surgeons. We're not going to be able to handle the number of people who need these types of procedures in the future. And when 2032 rolls around, no one's like, hey, was that study from 2024? Were they right? Like, no one ever goes back and checks if this was right or wrong. So you just get to state your case and you get off scot-free, basically. But no getting off scot-free here, because we're putting cases on hold. The first thing is that this is Pearl Diver, and it's important for anyone to recognize. If you're reading a Pearl Diver study or looking to use it, Pearl Diver is not nationally representative and it's not intentionally sampled. So right off the bat, you can't extrapolate Pearl Diver data to national estimates. It's just not structured that way. You have to use something like nationwide inpatient sample or get enough statewide inpatient data sets together that you can then make a case that maybe those figures are such that they could be representative of the U.S. population as a whole. But Pearl Diver is not it. So I think that this could actually, because Pearl Diver tends to have a better socioeconomic slant to it because there are a lot of insured, a lot of the data comes from insured patients or patients who have Medicare, plus they have like some other purchased coverage. So they may be a healthier population and also more inclined to activity, things that would put you at risk of a periprosthetic fracture potentially. So that right there can cause some question to enter into our minds whether these numbers are really going to be representative of the population as a whole, which is where the problem runs into when you start extrapolating. Second, past performance is not an indication of future behavior. So the experience of patients who had hip replacements and knee replacements in the decades prior to 2016 who are then developing the fractures, you know, these are probably like the end of the greatest generation, early boomers. They're not necessarily the same people who are going to be born in 1972 who are going to be 60 in 2032. So there can be inherent differences there. I also, very important in these types of studies, there's an immortal time bias in some degree where, like, you know, we just consider everybody who's, we just keep accumulating people. I don't see that death was handled as a competing risk. It may have been, but it's not described. Admittedly, their statistical section for a modeling study is a little bit sparse. So I don't see them explicitly say that they handled death as a competing risk and that's going to be a problem because it, obviously, if a patient passes away, they cannot have a periprosthetic fracture or have another surgery. So if we just assume everybody's living forever, the population just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, the numbers keep going up and up and up, that's a problem.
There's a fracture, I must fix it.
Right.
If they have a condition called asystole, I still need to fix that fracture.
Well, if they have a condition called asystole, they're not developing the fracture in the first place. So then, you know, an important point to emphasize here is that they used an open source time series forecasting library that uses the R platform. And this requires certain assumptions to be true within a data set. Namely, the data statistical variation is constant and follows an additive model, and that trends progress in a piecewise fashion. Now, I don't think any of those things are necessarily present in the context of periprosthetic fractures. So there's a lot of assumptions that their predictive algorithm takes into account that are not necessarily representative of the nature of periprosthetic fractures or the nature of periprosthetic fractures in this population. And then some of their conclusions, I don't think you needed this study to say that ORIF is more common after total knee arthroplasty, whereas revision hips are more common after periprosthetic fracture in total hips. I mean, just the nature of the area of the bone that's being involved is
different. Not rocket science.
Yeah. I don't think there's that much that's necessarily valid. It's a cool story. Like every other predictive model on these, like, you know, what does the future hold for orthopedic surgery? It's more cases, a flood of people. You know, the one, two times the number of people in 10 years from now are going to have the problem as compared to what we're dealing with currently. I don't think these ever really pan out the way people expect them to. And I don't see how that advances care or practice right now either.
That's the hard part. I agree. And that's the hard part with these big database studies, for sure.
Another creative way to get something out of the Pearl Diver data set. Harder and harder. We're scraping at bedrock.
I think the gift that keeps on giving, but once you squeeze the rock so much, there's only so much.
All
right, I'm going to go for a different type of study here. Audio distraction for traction
more
pin
RCTs.
Insertion.
Less Pearl Diver, more RCT.
Yeah. And hence we're talking about prospective randomized controlled trial on this by Albersheim et al. I selected this because I remember the first traction pin I ever did. And needless to say, my senior told me to YouTube a video of how to do it. It was a proximal tibial traction pin. I probably didn't put enough lidocaine in there. And I needless to say, the patient did have a little anxiety and a little bit of pain. So this might have been useful for me when I was a junior resident.
Were you using a regular drill or a hand drill?
I actually had a power drill. Did you use hand drill? I did.
Yeah, when I was an intern, we just had like the hand drill in the ER. It was like
That would be an interesting study of itself. Does the anxiety go up when you see your surgeon come up with something from the medieval times? The answer is probably yes. So this is a prospective randomized controlled trial at two level one trauma centers from 2018 to 2022. In that time frame, which is actually a lot of years, I would say they only did 54 patients. That might be a product of nowadays where we do probably less traction pins than we used to. There are 54 patients in the study, and it did cover over their calculated sample size, which was 42 participants or 21 in each group. Patients had to be greater than 18 years of age, who were conscious and oriented and had a medical need for skeletal traction. And they were included for distal femur and proximal tibia, understanding that they were not conscious, listening to music or audio distraction probably would be not as helpful. Patients were randomized to get an audio distraction. This was done with an MP3 player. I don't know where they got these from because I don't see many MP3 players nowadays. So that's surprising. With music, there were 10 preloaded music genres on there, and they could select one and listen to music as they were getting their traction pin, or they were randomized to not receive audio distraction during the procedure. Surveys were completed by the patient and the physician immediately following the procedure. Patients were asked to rate their overall experience, their anxiety during the procedure, and pain during the procedure, each on a 1 to 10 Likert scale, where lower number was a better outcome. The overall experience was rated from tolerable to not tolerable at all, and anxiety was not anxious at all to very anxious, and pain was no pain to the worst possible pain. And they similarly did a 1 to 10 Likert scale for assessing the perception of the overall difficulty of the procedure as completed by the surgeon doing the traction pin. Procedural difficulty was rated from easy to most difficult, again with lower number representing a better outcome. There are 28 patients in the audio distraction group and 26 in the no audio distraction group. Similar demographics, 60% of these were were femur fractures, followed by acetabular fractures. There's no difference in traction pin location and total procedure time between groups. From a statistical perspective, there was a little less time if the patient got audio distraction. If they didn't like the music, maybe the surgeon wanted to hurry up and get the pin in a little bit faster, but it was slightly less time with the audio distraction. Overall, patient reported procedure experience and pain were similar, so the pain perception was similar in both groups. Physician-reported difficulty was similar in both groups as well, too. Their only real finding was that anxiety levels were lower in audio distraction patients. They did a multivariable analysis in 54 study subjects, and they found that significant predictors of patient-reported pain levels during the procedure were the presence of polytrauma and opioid prescription prior to surgery, or prior to the presentation to the hospital. Interestingly enough, patients who had polytrauma had almost 2 units of lower pain, which I wouldn't expect. I would expect greater pain. And that opioid prescription, if you were on opioid prior to your presentation to the hospital, they had, not surprisingly, almost 3 times units higher pain, or 3 units higher pain. And then if you had audio distraction, you had 2 units of lower pain compared to those who did not have audio distraction. And what I did like about the study is actually a pretty simple intervention, right? You pop in some earbuds and you listen to some music and you basically just distract the person as they're getting a traction pin. We don't do as many traction pins as previously, so they may not be as relevant as time goes on. It's a small study with only 54 patients, but it is a simple intervention. So it could be used to try to distract patients during our not-so-fun interventions while we're in the ED, maybe extrapolated to things like if you're suturing a hand lack, doing an IND, or things like that in the ED. So ways to distract patients, maybe to reduce their anxiety a little.
Yeah, really good point. There's a lot of potential to extrapolate those findings to other distressing or procedural-based urgent or emergent procedures that for which distraction could be helpful.
So potential other presentations or other ways you can use it. The next we're going to go to and talk about the Your Case is on Hold featurette, long-term outcomes and arthroscopic label treatment for femoral acetabular impingement in adolescents, a nested propensity matched analysis. And I'll ask our stats wizard here to talk to us about that in a little bit. This is by Dom et al. And it's free for 30 days, so you can read it and check it out. So as is usual in orthopedics, longer is better. We don't often have long-term outcomes from any orthopedic procedures, let alone FAI in adolescents treated with hip scopes. So the purpose of this study was to report on survivorship and patient-reported outcomes at a minimum of 10-year follow-up in adolescent patients less than 19 years old who underwent hip arthroscopy for FAI and label tears, and compared the survivorship and outcomes in this population with those of a nested propensity matched young adult control group, which is defined as patients who are between 20 and 30 years old. I'm sad I'm not a young adult anymore, but that's just the reality of life. This was conducted between February 2008 and January 2012, and this included patients who underwent hip arthroscopy for FAI and labral tears after 3 months of non-operative treatment. They had a minimum 10-year follow-up, and they looked at these following PROMs: the modified Harris hip score, the non-arthritic hip score, the hip outcome score sport-specific subscale, and an international hip outcome tool 12, and a visual analog scale for pain. They also looked at patient satisfaction with the surgery and rated on a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 being completely dissatisfied and 10 being completely satisfied. They did exclude patients who had a preoperative tonus grade of greater than 1, a prior ipsilateral hip surgical procedure, and other prior hip ipsilateral conditions such as osteonecrosis, dysplasia, leg calf Perthes disease, or Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Interestingly enough, patients who converted to a total hip arthroplasty, their data was not included in the outcome score evaluations. So it wasn't really looked at as a, I would say, an intention to treat analysis, right? You can tell me more about this per se, but they didn't include patients who underwent total hip arthroplasty because it happened within the 10 years and they didn't want to include their outcomes there. They did do a sub-analysis. So they took a portion of the 74 patients that were in the study and matched them to the young adult patients using a one-to-one ratio based on sex, body mass index, tonus grade, lateral center edge angle, labral treatment type, capsular treatment type, and additional procedures performed during surgery, including acetabuloplasty, femoroplasty, microfracture of the acetabulum, microfracture of the femoral head, trochanteric bursectomy, gluteus medius repair, and notchplasty. They did do a sample size, and the reason I'm talking about this is just to understand they need to reach 80% power, and they assumed a difference of 8 points in the mean Harris hip score between the groups at the latest follow-up as being defined as clinically important, and they said that you needed 55 hips in each group using a one-to-one matching ratio. They started with 92 patients, but only 74 were included. Most were female, 61 out of the 74 were female, and had a minimum follow-up again of 10 years. The latest follow-up occurred at a mean of 125 months, and the range was 120 months to 144 months. There was no difference in mean LCA between the adolescent group and the young adult group. There was also no difference in mean alpha angle between adolescents and young adults. More patients presented with ligamentum teres tear in the young adults group, and more patients underwent iliopsoas fractional lengthening in the adolescent group than the young adult group. Of the 74 patients, they reported 100% survivorship with regards to having to undergo a total hip arthroplasty. So 100% of patients who were under 19 in the first 10 years did not undergo total hip replacement. For the young adult group, it was 96.6%. Now keep that in mind. If a patient presented at 28 years old, most patients would say, hey, why don't you try to wait a little bit longer before undergoing a total hip? So they might be candidates for total hip, for example, but were told to wait longer, so they did not undergo total hips. There were 9 patients who underwent revision hip arthroscopy in the case group. The average time to secondary arthroscopy was 43.9 months in the adolescent group and 28.1 months in the young adult group. The average time to conversion to total hip arthroplasty was 77.4 months in the young adult group. In the sub-analysis, they had 58 adolescents hip who were propensity matched to 58 young adult hips. The adolescent group had higher postoperative scores for the HOS-SSS, the NAHS, and the IHOT-12 than the young adult group. And the median scores for the young adult group for the NAHS, HSS, and the IHOT-12 were lower. And these were by points of 6 difference, 12 difference, and about 7 difference. But of note, remember I said that the sample size was based off the Harris hip score. The Harris hip score was not significantly different between groups, and the difference was only 3 between groups. And the sample size calculation was based off of a difference of 8, but they only experienced a difference of 3. Patient satisfaction at the latest follow-up was also significantly higher in the adolescent group, 8 versus 10. And they saw that adolescents undergoing hip arthroscopy for the treatment of FAI and labral tears demonstrated excellent outcomes and a high rate of survivorship. And these outcomes were superior to those seen in a matched adult group. It's nice to see that they had long-term follow-up. It would be nice to obviously see a larger cohort of patients. And the sample size and the propensity score matching, I'm curious what your take is from your viewpoint.
Yes. So from my viewpoint, this is not really a study that lends itself to leverage what advantages propensity score matching really give you. So it's a causal inference test, and causal inference tests are best used when you're trying to address confounding by indication. Patient A could have two surgeries, patient B could have two surgeries, but maybe one is more likely to get A one than the other. And so you're trying to sort of account for that or adjust that. In this case, you have like two different populations based on age. So my argument would be just take your whole cohort. You have the young group, you have the older group, and then do like a regression analysis that accounts. You have a larger power, you have a larger sample. Doing the propensity score matching, you're trimming your cohort as they did. They went from 74 to 58, and then I don't know how many in the young adult population they could have had, but obviously they just get 58 matches. We don't see the caliper really. I don't see that that was really specified. So, you know, propensity score matching, you can be very permissive or you can be very strict. The more permissive you are, the less the match is exact. So the first thing is, I don't really know what matching gives you here. It's a prism through which you're trying to adjust for other confounders. It's one way to do it. I'm not sure it's the best way to do it, especially since you're trimming the population and then you're left with a smaller cohort with sample-related issues. So as you pointed out, it's not just good enough to hit the number. You also have to hit the number and have the ability to detect the difference in the outcome of interest. So great, you hit the number, but like you're way off 5 points off of the Harris-Hipp score to detect a statistical difference. So your population didn't really play out the way you had planned it would. So, you know, I think that this is a retrospective study, and it's very easy to build around a retrospective study those like checkpoints of, oh, we did a power calculation and we did these things that you know, show you're doing methodologically rigorous work. But if all the parameters don't play out, then is it really methodologically rigorous at the end of the day? And I think that those are the questions that I have for this work. In addition to the fact that I think it's very challenging to create a paradigm as they do, which I call the Donnie Brasco paradigm, which we've actually discussed in previous episodes, where the counterfactual that they present doesn't help a patient in a clinical context. It's the Donnie Brasco paradigm because the Donnie Brasco character tells Al Pacino's character, Lefty Ruggiero, like, isn't this beautiful? And Al Pacino's response is, yeah, but it's not mine. It's not my, like, isn't this a beautiful thing? Yeah, it's not my thing though, right? So you're going to go tell an adolescent patient, or you'll have a better outcome than somebody who is older than you, or you'll tell somebody who's a young adult patient, well, if you were just younger, you'd have a better outcome. Like, how does that help them? Like, they're neither the other person that you're comparing them to. So when you have those kinds of paradigms, and that's like the main conclusion here, which is, adolescents undergoing hip arthroscopy for the treatment of FAI demonstrate excellent outcomes, and outcomes were superior to those seen in matched adult group. Okay, but how does that help either one of those two cohorts? And then they say that the results indicate that it's a safe procedure that leads to improvement in outcomes. Was that really, I mean, how long have people been doing these types of surgeries? Like, we're not sure if it's safe.
I think we know it's pretty safe.
Right, yeah.
We've got good data on that. All right, so moving to our honorable mentions here, starting off with lumbar facet arthroplasty versus fusion for grade 1 degenerative spondylolisthesis with stenosis, a randomized controlled trial by Nasser et al. There's a visual summary and it's permanently free. Among patients with lumbar spinal stenosis and grade 1 degenerative spondylolisthesis, decompression plus lumbar facet arthroplasty was associated with a higher rate of composite clinical success than decompression plus instrumented lumbar spinal fusion at 24 months postoperatively. Consistent factors influence body mass index thresholds for total joint arthroplasty across healthcare systems, a qualitative study. This is by Godziuk et al. The idea is that there are body mass index thresholds in the US typically, and this study looked at 69 Canadian surgeons on their views and use of BMI criterion thresholds for total joint arthroplasty access. They found that in these 69 surgeons, there were variable BMI thresholds in practice. There were 12 interconnected factors that influenced BMI considerations, such as variable evidence interpretation, surgical challenges, surgeon beliefs and biases, hospital differences, access to resources, health system bias, patient health status, patient fat distribution, patient decisional burden to lose weight or accept risk, evidence gaps and uncertainties, need for innovation, and societal views. 9 of these themes were similar with U.S. surgeons, so the majority were similar with U.S. surgeons. Item response theory validation of the forgotten joint score for persons undergoing total knee replacement by Qatari et al. This study applies item response theory to perform validation of the forgotten joint score according to contemporary standards. And the study found that the item response theory adopted forgotten joint score has potential advantages over a traditional forgotten joint score, provides continuous measures with finer granularity between health states, including individual measurement error. And this item response theory can compute scores despite more missing data, with only one response required to estimate a score. And it can be applied retrospectively to existing data sets or used to deliver individualized computer adaptive tests to try to reduce the number of questions that patients get when looking at PROMs. Now, note the forgotten joint score is a very important score, but it's not part of the patient reported outcomes that are being mandated by CMS for inpatient Medicare patients now. Tension distribution, articular surfaces of the rotator cable and crescent, a cadaver study by Yuri et al. Tension generated from the posterior region of the supraspinatus muscle and middle region of the infraspinatus muscle was evenly distributed to the anterior and posterior attachments of the rotator cable, while the tension generated from other supraspinatus and infraspinatus muscle regions were locally transmitted to the retrospective attachment area. And finally, contemporary aseptic revision total hyperarthroplasty in patients less than 50 years of age, results of over 500 cases by Carinder et al. There's a commentary on this too. Contemporary aseptic revision total hyperarthroplasties in patients less than 50 years of age demonstrated a re-revision risk of approximately 1 in 4 at 20 years. Dislocation, aseptic loosening of the femoral component, and periprosthetic joint infection were the most common reasons for re-revision. Index revision total hyperarthroplasty for dislocation had a 3 times higher risk of re-revision. So beware of them, especially in our younger patients. That's all we have for today. Thanks for tuning in. Tell your friends about us. And please tune in for the next time. We look forward to seeing you.